You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also chat with us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And as you go about your day, how often do you get a sense of being valued? How has the world assigned you a value? How much of your responsibility is it to understand your value as a worker and the things that we do each day? And the answer to that idle dinner party question,
what do you do?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that question. And we could start right at the bottom.
Take this job and shove it.
But there are jobs where the value is self-evident.
Take this job.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
There you go. And there are careers that at least seem to matter a lot.
Take this job and
let's make the most of this beautiful day.
Oh, Mr. Rogers, no argument there. And then there are jobs where the value is, shall we say, self-inflated.
Take this job.
You're fired.
Donald Trump, thank you. There are also people who maybe don't ever have to think about whether what they are doing is valuable at all.
We would search through the rubble to find makeshift desks and chairs or stools or something so that we could sit or they could sit. And we would see those patients right there in the tent, right in the midst in their communities.
Later this hour, a doctor making life and death decisions on the ground in rural areas devastated by the typhoon in the Philippines, improvising hospitals and clinics there, literally out of the rubble. But mostly this hour, we're going to explore the ambiguities of value in our economy. Do you have a sense of your value in the workplace? Tell us what it is. How do you see it? Then tell us if it has anything to do with how much you are paid. We might hear from a banker with a $2 million annual bonus, like the guy I met during the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations years ago, who, as he sat with demonstrators, people who had no idea he was a banker, quietly told me that he was paid way beyond the value of what he did. We might hear from some of you who believe you deserve a big raise. $15 an hour, for instance, making fast food, better benefits for teachers. Let's hear from all of you out there.
Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. As a judge, I make momentous decisions that affect people's lives and livelihood. I protect people from improper behavior from others. So my job really has significant value. I'm compensated at a lower rate because I am a state employee, but I suppose it's fair enough.
Thanks for that, Bruce. And we've got some wisdom from one of you in McKinney, Texas. The value of your job is what it is able to give back to you, you write. As a philosophy major, my career as a lifelong critical thinker is more rewarding to myself than any dollar amount can surpass. I would do my job for free. Let's welcome Al Ginnie to the program right now, professor of business ethics at Loyola University School of Business Administration. And for Chicago radio listeners, they know him as the longtime resident philosopher at station WBEZ. Al Ginnie, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Would you do your job for free?
Absolutely not. In point of fact, my brain and my commitment to my job leads me to do it out of love, but my body, my brother asks, requires at least $55,000 a year.
Perhaps one of the themes of your book, My Job, Myself. How does the economy assign value, and how do we extract our notion of our value from those around us, do you think?
Well, that's a dissertation question, and it's really the heart of the matter. The society doesn't assign value by the real worth of the job. The individual has to decide for themselves, does this have meaning as well as money for me? That quote from the judge, I think, was quite correct. I mean, the judge, in point of fact, makes much less than the trial lawyers in front of them at any given time, especially when you're talking about higher cases of importance in society. But they willingly are there and want to be there, et cetera, et cetera. The comment from the philosophy major sounded a little pretentious, but correct as well. If you really love what you do, there's compensation in that. But it's not simply enough to love what you do. You also have to be paid. And the great inequities in our society is we abuse those who love what they do and don't pay them. And then we don't pay the ones who have no other choice and they take what they can.
We abuse those who love what they do. Boy, that really is a takeaway point right there. That is a nugget. Is there economic value to that loving your job piece? And does it factor into the way businesses make decisions about human resources?
Well, you know, businesses say all the time now, it's the mantra, individuals, our most important asset, our people. And it's really true. It's not just a mantra. And the reality is, good workplaces are workplaces that are productive, and most productive workplaces don't just, you know, accumulate things and gadgets and whatnots. There's a happy workforce.
Al Genie, what would you advise someone who doesn't see themselves as valued either in their compensation or in their workplace? Is this their own personal responsibility? Is this a join the union kind of a question, or is it some sort of broader societal issue?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both. And in reality, what choices do we really have when push comes to shove? You either do what you want to do or you do what you need to do. What I tell my students, and I think I've written 3 or 4 books on work at this point, and that's been my work and it's been a passion. In reality, I started writing because I saw these brilliant students winding up in careers they didn't enjoy. And if you're going to find the work you love, you got to do it early, and you got to be willing to say no to certain things, and you got to be willing to take chances. I don't think finding work that you love means finding the cure for AIDS. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you did so? I don't think it always means being in charge of incapacitated a child's home or orphanage, et cetera, et cetera. Meaningful work, passionate work, is work for which you are fit, that you enjoy, that you have some competence in, and so therefore that's meaningful for you, and you feel you're making some contribution. By the way, I've been a student of life for more years than I want to admit on these airwaves, but in all these 70 plus years, what I found most exciting about life is people who actually fit at what they do, enjoy it, and recognize the pleasure of what they have.
Al Genie is professor of business ethics at Loyola University's Quinlan School of Business Administration. He's also the author of My Job, Myself. Al, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
This is The Takeaway. What's your value? Well, the government sometimes thinks that's an easy question to answer. If you're unemployed, you get this much for so long. Unemployment benefits aren't a real philosophically motivated effort to value people. Just a way to bridge the gap between jobs during an economic downturn, right? But the value of a worker goes down with prolonged unemployment. That's what the numbers show. Even though the official unemployment rate last month returned to pre-recession levels of 7%, long-term joblessness over the same period is up 213%. And some 1.3 million of those long-term unemployed Americans are looking at their unemployment benefits ending at the end of this year. Congress has so far failed to include an extension to those benefits in any budget deal. Joining us now is Cecilia Rouse, Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University and a former member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how does the value of a worker, at least in terms of labor economics, degrade with prolonged unemployment, being out of the workforce for a period of a year, 2 years, 3 years?
Well, that can happen in a number of ways. So first, worker skills may not be quite as up to date, quite as relevant, especially in very fast moving occupations. So they're just not quite as valuable to employers. A second way that they can degrade is that the workers themselves get discouraged. You imagine being out of work for a year or two, how just discouraging and depressing that is. And so workers themselves are not quite as eager, are not quite as productive, ambitious. But another way that it can occur is that employers themselves just think that the workers aren't as good or as qualified because they're not sure, is the worker out of work because they're not really qualified or because the workers just had bad luck? And when they have a lot of other workers that they can choose from, it's easy to overlook the longer-term unemployed. And it's that aspect which is really, you know, becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and becomes part of the vicious cycle of being unemployed for a long time.
So if we're talking about unemployment that's the result of the business cycle, it seems to me unemployment benefits make some sense because you really have a core of workers that you are pretty sure are going back to the workforce when the business cycle turns around. But in a prolonged recession and a deep recession like we had in 2008, it seems as though the better government policy is to separate those workers who you understand are cyclically probably going to return to the workforce and give them unemployment benefits, but the others, you need to work aggressively on making sure their value doesn't degrade. Unemployment benefits may actually hurt them, right?
Well, I don't know that unemployment benefits would hurt these workers, but I think you're right that it is time for us to talk about a second class of of policies that are really designed to address these long-term unemployed. So for the young people, it's really helping them get a foothold in the labor market, because the first 5 years of a young person's attachment to the labor force are critical. And for older workers, it may be job training programs, programs that help them take a chance on possibly a lower paying job, what we call wage insurance. So I think it is time to transition from simply relying on unemployment insurance to these more active labor market policies. But that said, in the meantime, I think many of us believe that the unemployment problem is still largely cyclical. These workers still have to feed themselves and their families, and they need to be contributing to our economic activity. So prolonging unemployment insurance for a bit longer still makes some sense.
Is it a government responsibility? Can the private sector actually make some of these investments as well?
I think, especially when it comes to job training, I think it's a shared responsibility, and not just with the government, I think workers as well, which is to say that when a worker is trained, the employer who trains that worker also benefits. Now, obviously, an employer worries that they train a worker and then the worker leaves. But I think we've seen great success with what we call sectoral employment and training programs, where employers who are in a certain sector that therefore share common skills come join together to train workers so that all those workers benefit and the employers do too.
But I'm wondering if you think Congress and Washington is out of touch with some of these best practices and that they're not really going in that direction right now.
Well, it doesn't seem that Congress right now is looking for innovation. I think they're looking for smart policy, but I think they're torn in so many different directions that it's not obvious that they will get behind innovative ways to address old problems.
Can I ask you one quick philosophical question before we go?
Sure.
When you were a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors in the Wall Street or in the White House cauldron there, was it easy for you to determine your value as a worker, as a member of the administration, or was that really tough?
I could see the parts of what I was contributing, but, you know, especially policy really is a group effort, and I think not one person can claim responsibility or, I don't know that I can measure exactly what I contributed, but you know, it's part of the team.
What's our value? It's a question for all of us, that's for sure. Thanks so much for allowing us to ask it of you. Cecilia Rouse is Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, a former member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You say it like this.
Measuring your value, how do you do it? And does it have anything to do with what you're paid?
This is Trixie. I measure the value of my job by the enjoyment it gives me and the freedom it affords me, for which I consider myself well and fairly compensated. I sell antiques and collectibles on eBay. I love to shop. I love to sell. I even love to ship the packages. What can I say? I love my job.
Thanks, Trixie. Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. And coming up, the priceless value of a doctor who shows up in a disaster zone where everything has been swept away. An angel in the Philippines in a moment here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Our next guest, Dr. Selwyn Mahone, hasn't spent a lot of time recently contemplating whether he is valuable or not. He is a disaster medicine fellow at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. After Typhoon Haiyan hit the Philippines more than a month ago, killing nearly 6,000 people, injuring 26,000 more, Dr. Mahone arrived on the scene of a modern city, Tacloban, with its medical infrastructure nearly totally destroyed. Along with a small team of doctors, Mahone treated almost 1,400 people in a tented clinic near a badly damaged hospital. And he says that the medical work in the Philippines is just beginning.
Things are constantly evolving in the Philippines. When we got there, there were still a significant amount of people who had not received any medical care. They chose to remain in their destroyed home, which pretty much just looked like rubble. And they were somewhat disconnected from the regular roadways. It was very difficult for help to get to some of them. So what you saw were a lot of hungry, dirty, malnourished folks with wounds that they had not taken care of, and also were now getting respiratory illnesses, coughs, colds, even pneumonias, gastrointestinal, because they did not have clean water. Those who had chronic illnesses didn't have access to their regular medication, so their chronic problems were getting worse.
In many ways, the prolonged lack of treatment is a new kind of disaster.
It's unfortunate that when we talk about planning and preparedness, it takes a while often for the resources to get to people, even in the best of situations. And so what you see is the injuries that occur directly because of the event, whether it be something as violent as an earthquake or tornado or hurricane or typhoon, like in this case. And then eventually, after those injuries occur, you start having the subacute injuries, the infections, and the resurgence of all the medical problems that are brought on just by either not having medication or just the stress of the event that has exacerbated their normal medical problems.
What was it like in this tented clinic that you worked in largely in Tacloban, which is right next to, and I suppose there's an irony to that, a hospital that's severely damaged?
It was pretty grim, and oftentimes we would search through the rubble to find makeshift desks and chairs or stools or something so that we could sit or they could sit, and we would see those patients right there in the tent, right in the midst in their communities. Sometimes we were fortunate that we would go to a community and they had standing structures who would like go into a school and we'd set up the clinic in there. And we most of the time did not have our normal complement of medication and equipment. But the need was so significant that almost anything that we did was valued and made a significant impact.
And you have to improvise in a situation like that, even with medical care and recovery. There's no script to it. You spent a fair amount of time in helicopters, right?
Initially, we went to the spheres that were close to the hospital. The further we ventured, the more difficult it was to get there because many of the roadways weren't necessarily capable. So we would have to helicopter in, and that itself was interesting.
From the air, and you're a disaster medicine fellow at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, from the air, I gather you can really see the sense of randomness and, injustice, for lack of a better word, of how a typhoon will destroy one place, spare another, one island untouched, the other island completely devastated. You saw that.
Yes, it was humbling. I mean, it looked like a mighty hand just swept across, just smashing things as it went by. Some stood, some didn't. The issue with Tacloban was twofold in that not only was it a Category 5 typhoon, is that a storm surge followed, which most of the times when we think of massive waves, we think of tsunamis that occur after earthquakes, but it's something similar. And so you have the injustice of this mighty wind that's followed by a bulldozer of water just coming through. I think a lot of the people who lived on the island had in some way been aware of typhoons. They felt that they could weather it. But the storm surge, I don't think they were prepared for that. And one of the horrifying things is that in Tacloban, in order to prepare for the hurricane, a lot of the villagers were moved to a convention center. But when the storm surge came in, those on the bottom floor, many of them were killed. So hundreds of them were killed in this very same convention center. But I think they mostly planned for the typhoon and the storm surge. They couldn't fathom the severity of that.
I'm wondering, during this experience, if you asked yourself the question, and you've used the word grim more than a couple of times, if you asked yourself, I wonder if I'm really cut out for this disaster medicine business.
Well, this is my chosen field. I also deployed to Haiti back in 2010, and so I had some expectation of what I would meet. I didn't try to pre-think it, but The reason that some of us are drawn to disaster medicine is because, for me, it's the absolute purest form of medicine, in that I was trained as an emergency medicine physician and very accustomed to dealing with folks at the worst part of their lives in significant suffering. But even in the confines of regular medicine, there is so much what we call red tape and bureaucracy. There's the billing, the legal, all those different things. Whereas in disaster medicine, there is just the need, one human being in need requiring help. And they require food, they require water, and just my expertise happens to be medical care. And so we both meet in that very, very humbling time where we both can provide a service to each other, and there is no other requirement other than we do the best for each other as we can.
Dr. Selwyn Mahone is disaster medicine fellow at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, returned from the typhoon devastation in the Philippines. Dr. Selwyn Mahone, thanks so much.
Thank you.
More about the recovery efforts in the Philippines coming up, how lives can be saved in a disaster by remote control from a computer screen thousands of miles away, the miracle of geospatial mapping. That's coming up here on The Takeaway. Staying with the Philippines for a moment, we want to talk about a job that didn't exist even 4 years ago. Dale Kuntz has helped save lives in the Philippines, just like Dr. Mahone, but he has gone nowhere near the place. He's a geospatial engineer at the American Red Cross, coordinating the efforts of online volunteers who respond to disasters by using GPS and satellite technology to make accurate maps of devastated areas in real time, compare them to pre-disaster images, and calculate for on-the-ground relief workers who exactly might need help and whether there's any way to get to them. Quite literally, it's big-picture disaster relief. Dale Kuntz just started his job with the American Red Cross 6 months ago, and Typhoon Haiyan has both proved once again the value of this geospatial disaster relief and has provided crucial data for the next big disaster.
Hiring me and my job is all part of a sort of a scale-up that was thought about 3 years ago and really came out of the response in Haiti, sort of the need and desire for maps. Hopefully we're going to expand some more and sort of communicate more with the community and hopefully do some more good work.
A humanitarian startup. It sounds pretty exciting. How do people get mobilized to assist in this map-making process in a kind of real-time way, and use the typhoon in the Philippines as an example, if you could?
For the typhoon, we basically knew that the typhoon was going to hit, and it was going to be pretty bad, starting on Wednesday, maybe Thursday, before the typhoon hit. And then on Thursday, we started to coordinate with the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team. And they're a bunch of volunteers sort of all around the world, and their life is dedicated to creating better maps for people in humanitarian situations, so that responders like the Red Cross can have a better map so that we can understand sort of what was there and sort of how to get places, because a lot of times there is no map. And especially here in the Philippines, where we're talking about, there was no map. The most recent one was from the 1950s, done by the U.S. government.
So
the military, actually.
Tell me how this stuff actually saves lives.
Yeah, so we get aerial imagery from the Humanitarian Information Unit from the Department of State. They give us aerial imagery, and then sort of folks around the world, you know, in this high-end response, there's over 93 countries, people in 93 countries contributed. They made 4.5 million edits, and sort of, you know, you trace what's there, a building, a road, and then that information gets taken, is sort of collected by me and by other people in the NGO world, and we use that to give our folks that are either in the field already or going to the field a better understanding of sort of what they face, what is actually out there, how to get from point A to point B, the number of buildings, and get an understanding sort of the fabric of a community, so that there's more residential neighborhoods to the north, because maybe there was no telephones and people in these places being able to reach out and say, hey, we need help here. We're able to sort of see that from space, basically, and then direct people to those places.
So someone in the media might just insult you by calling you a nerd, but in fact, you're a huge sort of geological, geographic fact checker in real time for a humanitarian team that needs high-quality information now. You make a mistake, a van may get stuck for 3 days.
Yeah, and you know, myself and I think a lot of the other folks in the humanitarian sort of GIS world, we embrace the term nerd. We call ourselves geo-nerds. And one of the power of the map is that because so many different people are editing it, because it's a lot like Wikipedia. You know, if I make a small mistake, somebody else is going to catch that when they're looking through it. And there's more experienced mappers working with more less experienced mappers, and we're able to sort of create a really, really good base map really quickly.
What's next now? What do you think the capability is as we continue to scale upward?
The American Red Cross, we deployed a GIS professional. So he's actually there on the ground in the Philippines doing an assessment of how well we were able to map the damage from the air. And we're hoping to use that both in the Philippines sort of moving forward, and then in later instances, sort of how we find where people are and where we find where the damage was. And we can do that a lot quicker so we can get them help quicker.
It sounds very exciting and definitely life-saving. Dale Kuntz, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Dale Kuntz is a senior geospatial engineer at the American Red Cross. Let's take a look now at a big move by the Obama administration to step away from the conflict in Syria. Yesterday, the administration announced it would stop sending non-lethal aid like food, computers, and vehicles to the moderate opposition in Syria, at least temporarily, to avoid subsidizing jihadist groups allied with the opposition. We turn now to Andrew Tabler. He's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, also author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
So has there been a tipping point here in the U.S. approach to the opposition in Syria, either from the Washington side or from the Syrian side?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a tipping point, but it's certainly not a situation that Washington or its allies really want. We have a problem in that over time, following the Obama administration's backing down from using punitive strikes in Syria to punish the Assad regime, the opposition there is very angry. Things have shifted towards the right, and a lot of Salafist brigades have taken over the space that was formerly populated by moderates and the ones that we backed.
Now, this was anticipated. I mean, if a prolonged civil war and prolonged chaos in a country encouraged the development of the Taliban and al-Qaeda in places like Afghanistan and Somalia, and before that, even in Lebanon during its long civil war, we could only have anticipated that this eventually would be the result.
That's correct. And many people, even in government and outside of government, pointed this out. We've seen this coming for a long time. Those that have been following Syria, have made recommendations concerning dealing with the rebels in one way, shape, or form. But thus far, the policy has been to keep our hands off of Syria. And unfortunately, it's going in a direction that we don't like.
Now, we can blame the opposition all we want, but there is a certain inevitability to this, and you've just described it so well. What can the opposition do now to change things, to make itself more credible, to separate itself from jihadists?
Right. It's a good question. On a recent visit there, I spoke with the rebels about this. One is to realize, and I think we need to realize this in Washington, this war is going to go on for a very long time. So there is time to adjust course. I think that the rebels need to shun al-Qaeda affiliates, and we have at least two operating inside of Syria. And they need to look at it not just from a terrorism standpoint, but because those groups are not, after Syrian national goals. They have extraterritorial goals. So they need to do that. The other, I think, really is just to look at, well, what is it that really they can do and what can we do to work with them in an environment in which, the situation is very bad. President Assad's troops are gaining on them, albeit slowly. And the situation's rapidly worsening concerning humanitarian relief.
It would seem that the decision point for Iran is maybe even more tantalizing than what the U.S. might do at this point and the allies might do at this point, in that Iran, on the one hand, supporting Assad, may sense a victory in the cards here, or at least a restoration of power.
Right.
But they also could play a card here that would dramatically change their relationship with the rest of the world and certainly the United States by coming in and reshuffling the opposition and suggesting that Assad is not in fact their ally.
Yeah, it's possible. Thus far, though, Iran has come in heavy and hard in Syria, whether it's the intervention of Hezbollah from neighboring Lebanon, which Iran backs, or IRGC Quds Force or other Shia militias from Iraq. You know, they've also intervened there as well. The question is if a nuclear deal would soften that stance. And most people are saying no. Actually, most people say that while the reformers in Iran would get their deal on the nuclear program and sanctions relief, it's the hardliners in Iran, Qasem Soleimani and company, that would get back, you know, a lot of Syrian territory and solidify their hold there. And that means that the war there, whether there's a nuclear deal or not, is likely to go forward for the foreseeable future.
A prolonged war in Syria seems to be the near-term future for that country, and with implications certainly for the region. Andrew Tabler, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Andrew Tabler is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. You know, maybe if we had our priorities straight in the U.S., among the most valuable people who have lived in the last century was Dr. Jonas Salk, the man who developed the vaccine for polio.
The effort to eradicate the disease started small, with Dr. Salk and his team immunizing a few thousand students in the Pittsburgh area. But soon, it became a nationwide mobilization to protect every child against the polio threat.
Salk's research was responsible for a global change in public health. And there's a new call today as leaders in medicine and science convene in London to tackle the escalating rate of dementia and Alzheimer's disease, anticipated in our time to soon become some of the biggest burdens on the global economy and healthcare around the world.
If we don't come up with something, our whole healthcare system's going to get bankrupted by this disease. I mean, and people that understand that realize that this is panic mode we're in right now. It's panic mode.
That's University of California, San Diego researcher Dr. Steve Wagner, who believes more needs to be done to mobilize to find an effective treatment for Alzheimer's. Wagner is just one of a number of leading Alzheimer's researchers profiled in a new series airing all this week on our partner station WGBH in Boston. The series is called Desperate for a Cure, The Search for New Alzheimer's Treatments, and it's produced by WGBH and WCAI senior reporter and editor Sean Corcoran, whose work took him to some of the very same research clinics where the polio vaccine was developed decades ago. Corcoran says there's lots of worry out there that the passion for treating Alzheimer's needs to match the intensity of successful medical mobilizations of years past.
Part of the government doesn't seem to have quite completely come around to the idea that you need to have a war on Alzheimer's, perhaps like you had a war on cancer. So in the research community, some will say they're getting more and more support from the federal government, from the NIH and the different departments. Others would say that not everyone has opened their eyes to the fact that the government needs to play a role in some of this basic science.
And to assemble your series, you know, part of the reason you need to go so many places is because there are so many different kinds of questions about detection, about onset, about how the brain actually works, about what it is you would actually intervene on to treat. Describe the scope of what you've tried to do here.
I tried to look at where the science is now and what directions different researchers are going. Some researchers are dealing with the compounds themselves, the drugs that they hope will go after the different proteins that seem to go awry in Alzheimer's disease. But other researchers have gone in just as important directions when it comes to the mice models or the rat models that they're going to be testing these drugs in. And then you have another group that's looking at how can we see the pathology, how can we see those proteins in the brain in the living brain. So that's how you would know, is a drug working?
And many of them tell you stories of failures, of drugs that really didn't work for a variety of pretty interesting reasons. A couple of stories there.
Yes, the bulk of the research has zeroed in on this one particular protein called amyloid beta, A-beta, beta amyloid. It's all the same stuff. And so much of the drug discovery has been around that. But what they did was they tried to stop the production of that almost completely, and that didn't work. People got very sick, and so they had to stop a lot of those trials. So now we're looking at maybe the third phase of these drug trials directed toward this amyloid beta. And the hope is now that rather than just shutting it off, they can modulate it in a certain way. And they make the analogy to cholesterol. You can't just shut off cholesterol. But if you turn it down and have it at a healthy level, perhaps the plaques won't build up in our arteries. Well, the plaques in the brain are a bit different, but that's the analogy that they're using.
So Steve Wagner really described this sort of hammer approach that needs to be modified to be much more subtle, and that's what's exciting about the study about to get underway in Boston. Here's Dr. Risa Sperling describing how maybe they have stumbled onto a strategy that could work.
It's a very large study, so we're looking for 1,000 individuals who meet the criteria to come into the study. That is evidence of amyloid building up in their brain, but people who don't yet have any clear symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
So finding the amyloid gunk in the brain early enough to be able to develop a strategy to treat it. Is that what's going on there?
They want to be able to see it early enough before any symptoms are there. That's right. And then can they cut down on the amyloid so that these plaques don't build up at such a rate? The idea is if you can even delay this disease by 15 years or so, people have usually passed away by that point, so it's not going to cause a problem. So they're looking at preventatives rather than cures.
And so much of what's driving this is a technology that will allow us to have better and better images of the brains so that we can have better and better descriptions of what is even going on with Alzheimer's. Here's Dr. Bill Klonk, who's a clinician and researcher at the University of Pittsburgh.
What we thought we would have now was an effective anti-amyloid agent that would modify the disease process. But as of yet, we have no approved drug in that category. So the imaging technology has important uses, but it really, I think, is best described as sitting there waiting for its therapeutic partner.
This is the huge takeaway. How frustrating must that be for scientists? They can get a dye in there to actually embrace the agent well enough to be able to see it in images, but there's no drug that can get where the dye can go.
Some are in the pipeline that they say can get into the brain, do get into the brain, and they address very specific amyloid, amyloid of a certain size, the longest form that really gets the stickiest. So there is stuff in the pipeline. That one doctor I saw, Dr. Wagner, as we mentioned out at UCSD, is he has a whole team of pharmaceutical experts working as consultants. The NIH put them together. The NIH wants the pharmaceutical company in early on these drugs to help them along and so that they're prepared to really put them right into trials quickly.
Would you say this is a hopeful story or a frustrating story of the government and the private sector and medical science not able to get out of each other's way?
I'm all over the place when it comes to that. You speak to some of the doctors and they're very discouraged at, you know, I think there's been 100 drugs that have failed over the past 13 years. Others say we might have something in 5. Others say you might have something in 20. I was extremely encouraged by just how many researchers are involved and how committed they are and how seriously they're taking it. However, when you look at the government putting $500, $600 million a year towards basic research of this disease, that is discouraging. You and I know we're building high schools in this country for a couple hundred million in some cases, but we're only putting $500, $600 million towards Alzheimer's research each year.
A disease which may end up costing tens of billions in the next several decades. Sean Corcoran, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor for WGBH and WCAI. His series on seeking a cure for Alzheimer's is called Desperate for a Cure, the Search for New Alzheimer's Treatments.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
An ancillary question regarding how do we find our value in this economy is a much more visceral question. Am I rich?
If I were a rich man.
Who is rich? It pushes a lot of buttons.
Eat the rich. There's only one thing the bank can afford. Eat the rich.
Am I rich? Eat the rich. So, who is rich?
Hi, my name is Christy. I'm calling from Martinez, California. I have a very easy job. I do security for a biotech firm. And most of my job is mostly observing and stopping occasionally suspicious-looking people. So I believe I get compensated fairly. I mean, obviously, I could use a few more bucks here and there. But for what I do, I get paid fairly.
Thanks, Christy. Christy kind of sounds rich there. But is it just that she's happy? You know, each one of my children, for various reasons, has asked that very same question. Mommy, Daddy, are we rich? And my answer to that over the years has been yes, or maybe, or compared to what, dear? And sometimes it's yes, even though there's a gnawing feeling inside that I feel as far from rich as you can get. A feeling that is real, even if the idea numerically is absurd. You may have noticed in the media all that talk back during debates in Congress over tax breaks for the rich and the cutoff point for the tax breaks, typically around an annual income of $250,000 a year. Now, you would regularly hear pundits on financial channels saying things like, I know that sounds like a lot of money, but here in New York, try sending your kid to private school and paying rent in a decent neighborhood. Hey, folks, it's not rich, blah, 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 blah. Well, who is rich? I mean, according to new data from the Associated Press, 20% of American adults at some point in their lives earn at least $250,000 a year. This class of the I can't believe I'm rich is a new kind of middle class, a feast and famine class that better not spend it all now class, a just enough to be able to see how far away from total financial security the really wealthy are. And for most Americans, give me a break, $250,000, hey, just shut up. With us is Michael Norton, professor at Harvard Business School and co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
This is a really subtle idea, this notion of rich. And is the $250,000 mark just a sign of inflation, or is there a realignment in the economy going on in some way?
I think if you think about what it means to be rich, you can think about if you had $250,000 for 1 year of your life versus if you had that guaranteed for every year of your life. So the new data suggests that many Americans, probably more than we think, will at least one time have that amount of money. It doesn't mean they're going to have it next year, and it doesn't mean they had it last year. It doesn't necessarily mean they're rich so much as they had one good year, and maybe in other years they're still struggling.
You know, it's almost like to have financial security, we need to think more like, you know, an athlete for the NFL or the NBA, that you're going to have three good seasons and you better plan for most of your life not being on the court or on the field, and that that's the way most Americans need to look at this $250,000 figure if they're in the workforce.
I think that's exactly right. And again, if you think about what it means to be rich, let's say you've got a house that cost you $1 million. Well, that's great, but if you're $2 million in debt, you're not rich, and making $250,000 isn't going to help that much in terms of getting you out of the hole. If you think about everything you have minus everything you owe, that's really the way to think about whether you're rich or not, not your income in any given year.
So income isn't a good way of viewing the 1%, 99% trade-off that gets batted around in the media all the time. Is that what you're saying on some level?
It's related to it, but if you look at inequality of income and inequality of wealth, and often we confuse the two, but they are really – income is just what you made this year, and wealth is everything that you have. It turns out that income inequality is much less than wealth inequality, that it's really wealth that's really distributed very differently among Americans. Income is as well, but wealth is really where we see these big disparities.
Who do we think these 250K folks are? They're not probably doctors who go work in the Philippines. They're probably not – people selling antiques on eBay, both of whom we spoke with this hour, who seem very, very happy and very, very rich, spiritually speaking. Who are these 250K folks?
I think a lot of these people are, and if you look at the data as well in the survey, they're people who did kind of have one good year, and they're not really rich in the way that we think that all of their problems are solved and every day they just walk around with a huge smile on their face. And in fact, most research suggests that it isn't really the amount of money you have that makes you happy anyway. It's these warm and fuzzy things like having friends and family and having a partner who loves you. Even if you hit – if you're lucky enough to hit $250,000 a year, it just doesn't mean all your problems are solved.
You know, in looking at this survey, it really reminded me that, you know, philosophically speaking, we are back in the 1930s in the way we view the economy. I mean, you go to college and you're going to find a secure job. That's just not the way things work anymore. I'm wondering if we should reorient our society to taking advantage of that great year, both for the security of the individual workers, but also getting them to invest that money and make jobs better or companies better, or just use it as more of an economic force rather than simply going, I hope I get a job. And then when you get fired, realizing there's no job security anyway. And I just think it's really outmoded, and there needs to be a Happy Money's science of smarter spending approach to the economy as a whole?
We really do try to encourage both individuals to think about, given all the money you're going to make in your life, whether it's a small amount or a large amount, how are you going to use that to have the best outcomes for yourself? And we do, in fact, talk to companies and governments to think about how do we encourage everyday people to use the money that they have. And again, not all of us are lucky enough to have, you know, $250,000. But even if you make less money than that, how do you use that money to really improve the quality of your life in the long run rather than focus on buying stuff for yourself today that really isn't going to change your life very much?
What about the idea that came in really the 1960s, cost of living increases, the idea that you're going to find a job that's going to track you incrementally upward so that you're always going up? In fact, a lot of people are really going down now incrementally.
That's right. The data shows that if you look at the gains in income over the last 20 to 30 years, almost all of those gains have gone to the very wealthiest Americans and people who make the minimum wage. We know the minimum wage hasn't changed because it's been in the media a lot lately. But even the middle class, people's outcomes have not changed. And if anything, their real wages, their purchasing power has gone down over the last 30 years in America. That's really very different than how most Americans think about America, which is the middle class prospers along with the rest of the nation. We really have not seen that since the 1980s.
So a couple of ways of thinking about you, Michael Norton, professor at Harvard Business School, successful author, top of your game, right? Or an academic, you're struggling. Do you feel rich?
I feel subjectively rich, meaning that my life is very, very good in terms of my everyday life. I think in our research, we often ask people how much money will make you happy. And people nearly always say two or three times as much as I have right now. And that means you're never going to be happy with how much money you have. It's time to start shifting from thinking about money and starting to think about the other things in your life that make you happy as a way to really have a good life.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael Norton is professor at Harvard Business School, co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. So are you a rich man or woman? And regardless of your wealth or value, are you compensated fairly for what you do? Oakland, California. I was fortunate enough to teach for 33 years. I worked with elementary level special education students and loved my job passionately. I was proud to be doing real work, important work. My district paid well compared to others in the area, and I considered my passion to be a component of my remuneration. Well, that is some great wisdom. You can be a part of the conversation. Be one of our listeners. I'm John Hockenberry. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.